dead old pieces calling in the bonds of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. Yoda and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church. Today I've invited Brother Kieran Finn to a Zoom recording for a broadcast. Brother Kieran, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Yoda Bayate.
Brother Kieran Finn is a Champagnat brother and Bible scholar. He's originally from Gisborne and has spent many years in adult education, teaching scripture in New Zealand and abroad. Titi Ponomo Study in Joy is currently running a new series with Brother Kieran. It is called The Women in the Bible. Brother Kieran, we have now gone through some stories of the women in the Bible, and we've reached the point where we are going to talk about Esther. And Esther, which is the celebration in the Jewish community, the celebration of Purim. And it's also a name that is well known. Many people, many women are called Esther. So it's not as rare in our society as some other names we've had. Can you tell us a little bit more about the setting of the book of Esther?
Well, I hope those who carry the name of Esther are stars in their own right. So, yes, the setting, who actually told it, it's the third year of the reign of Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, as he's sometimes called. And it's set in all the splendor and the pageantry of the Persian Empire, in the capital, Susa, in the royal court, with possibly the biggest bash in history, the party that lasts 180 days and involves everybody of any standing, and eventually even the poor get involved in it. But you have to ask who was running the empire during that time.
So many days, is that an exaggeration?
Well, exaggeration is one of the things that happens through the book. That's probably a key word. It's the rejection of one queen, Vashti, allows the rise of another, Esther. That's one of the stories. There are a couple of important stories. And, of course, the royal harem and all the rest of it, all the young virgins of the empire, of Ahasuerus's states. Now, that's the first story. Now, the second story is the professional competition for high office, and that implicates all the Jews in the fate of Mordecai. Mordecai, of course, is the guardian or the uncle of Esther. The opulence and the glamour of the Persian court is in striking contrast to the insignificant inhabitant of Susa by name Mordecai, the Jew. By the end of the story, Mordecai is prime minister and Haman, his deadly rival, is executed. In the course of all this action, Mordecai's insubordination, refusing to bow to Haman, who has risen to power, that leads to an attack on the entire Jewish population in the empire. Esther then enters as the principal character to save her people. And in chapter 9, which has a completely different tone to the other 8 chapters, which are the stories, the interwoving of those two stories, it's a Jewish victory, and hundreds die in Susa, and in the province, you get actually something like 75,000 people killed, executed, who are the enemies. Now, there's a different tone in that last chapter, but also the first part, half of the chapter, is the Purim contact of those two stories with that festival of the Jewish people.
So you had to fight against good and bad. You had Haman, the bad one, and Mordecai, the good one.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so the good one was oppressed, and then he, in the end, he was the winner.
Yeah, it's interesting that that's kind of like you have books, stories like the Joseph story, similar type of pattern. Daniel has got a similar type of pattern as well. The good Jewish person in the foreign court or the foreign empire, right? And those stories, those patterns do come through. That literary form, those similar stories circulated in the diaspora, the dispersion, Jews exiled from their homeland. Some see the book as a sort of a festal legend, a fictitious account to explain the feast and the celebration of Purim. The word Pur means lot. And of course, in order to find out when this execution of all the Jews is to take place, the lot is cast. Pur.
Oh, that reminds me of Jesus, and the lot is cast.
Oh, explain that one.
About his clothes. When he
they're dicing at the foot of the cross. Yes. Yeah, so of course, it was a common practice in those days in the empire at the beginning to actually cast lots to determine the fate of different nations.
Ah, did they believe that God would make sure that the lot,
the gods of other empires, but still, even in the Bible, there are accounts where, like when the failure to take the city of Ai in the book of Judges, they cast lots to find out who the guilty party is.
Mm.
So, and certainly, it was part of Jewish practice, all right.
It's like a judgment by God.
Yes. Well, where the lot falls, right? So, yes, it's an interesting book. There's an element of wisdom in it, because how do you survive as a good Jew within a foreign country that you are exiled to? Because at the back of all of this is the Babylonian exile. And that's how Mordecai becomes part of this lot that had been exiled in 587 with the first wave of exiles before the destruction, 10 years before the destruction of Jerusalem and Judah, going into exile. So it's an interesting detail, because it means that Mordecai is over 100 years old when all this action starts. So again, the element of exaggeration is there.
And we have the foreigners again. Last week we talked about Ruth, and Ruth was a foreigner in Judah. And now we are talking about Jewish people as foreigners in Persia.
Yes, living in these foreign situations. So, you know, what sort of book are we dealing with? Well, it's not history, but it's like history. It's kind of like a historical novel to entertain and to teach. The truth lies in what message is it teaching. And as the prophet Jeremiah said, you are to live in this foreign culture. You are to pray for its leaders, and you are to be good citizens, family, live there. And of course, when you did have the time to return, there was only a small percentage of people did return to their homeland. And there was the edict of Cyrus the Persian. So yes, there's a sort of an overall setting covering all of that.
And so what was the purpose? The purpose, you said, it was to teach. It was like a teaching tool. You had a story and had good and bad, and you had Esther being courageous and being listening to her uncle. and praying before acting. So the purpose is about this meeting and education. Is that right?
No, well, there's a little detail there, praying before acting, because we remember we are dealing with two versions of the story. And the Hebrew text, which is chapters 1 to 10, that's actually in a Protestant Bible, and it's in the Hebrew Bible. That's the Hebrew text. The Hebrew text does not mention the name of God once. So it's the message is getting across is the message of, we saw it in the book of Ruth, that when people do what they're supposed to do, God can sit back with a degree of satisfaction. Right? Now, the Hebrew, it doesn't mention God once, but the name of the king of Persia, that's given 190 times in 167 verses. God trusts the human creature to carry out the formidable task of ordering the world, a vote of confidence in human effort. God is a hidden causality, a bit like what we saw. It so happened that Boaz came to the field. This element of coincidence and so on. So the author implies that the Jews were not to be reluctant to assume their responsibilities in the diaspora. They do count, and they can make a difference. The author speaks of Jews, never of Israel. These are people who are away from their homeland. And a dual allegiance is held to the Persian government and to the Jewish people by the author as well as by Esther and Mordecai. That's the Hebrew text. When you come to the Greek editions, then you have a different type of presentation. You have there people praying. You have there people calling on God. The additions add different elements to the story. God is mentioned as being active and involved. God does respond. So there's a Greek text and a Hebrew text. And my recommendation is read the Hebrew text first. Now, in our Bibles, okay, the Hebrew Bible and a Protestant Bible will just have the Hebrew text. Our texts tend to have, the Protestant Bible will have a piece called the Apocrypha, and they will have the additions there. They may even have helpfully put the original Hebrew text, the Hebrew and Greek text together in a sequence. But my recommendation is read the Hebrew text, then read it with the additions.
So the Hebrew text is the first. When was it written, the book of Esther? Was it written right afterwards? Did the people tell the story until they came to the promised land?
Yeah, the oral history of telling the story, you get these references to Persia, you get the absence of any Greek loan words. That's probably a date between the 4th and 5th century for the Hebrew text. The Greek text, these additions would have developed as time went on, and they could have gone down as far as about the 3rd, 2nd or 3rd century. Because remember, when the Bible gets translated into Greek with the Septuagint, then you have this development of the texts. So 2nd century possibly is late for the additions.
Second century before Christ? Yes.
You get to the point that somebody reads the text and feels uncomfortable that God's not there and that they're not praying and they're not being very Jewish anyway, because A, Esther marries a Gentile, B, the dietary laws aren't being observed. Torah is not mentioned. The struggle of Jews living in such a culture in exile. Well, they're just waiting for the 70 years to pass for the return. Yeah. Well, some of them are.
So you have already told a little bit about the plot. Can you give a little bit more details so that listeners who haven't read it yet hear a little bit more about the plot?
Oh, dear. Well, the plot. It's this trial and triumph. Intrigue in a foreign court. Readers were attracted to stories of conflict and contexts and contests where power and wealth are rewarded. You see, when you're looking at a plot, you're looking at the Jews being threatened with extinction. And then through the actions of Esther and Mordecai, both steadfastly loyal to their religious traditions, the Jews are not only saved, but the fate plotted against them recoils upon their enemies. And it's fascinating how often this recoiling has got this element of delightful, you know, people get what they deserve. Haman builds this huge gallows, or really it's just a big spike to impale someone on. That's going to be his enemy, Mordecai the Jew. But alas, he himself ends up on it. Poetic justice. People get what they deserve. So people, they then celebrate their deliverance with the festival of Purim. Well, the story begins with Esther becoming queen. Our heroine is introduced to us early on. She's Jewish, but her uncle has told her not to let anybody know she's a Jew. So then we have this contrast with the royal queens. Vashti wouldn't come when she was summoned. Esther comes when she's not summoned. You see these delightful reversals all the way through. Feasting and banquets. There are 10 banquets in this story.
So just quickly, Vashti is the first wife.
And the first wife,
because she didn't do what the king said.
That's right. And of course, she wasn't keen on coming to a drunken lot gathered around her husband. And this wonderful, you know, they are to drink without limit. And then, of course, for the Feast of Purim, you are to drink as much as when you reach a point when you can't say, blessed be Mordecai, and cursed be Haman. When you've got them mixed up, you've had enough to drink.
Oh, that's the litmus test.
That's the festival, right? So, yes. Then with Esther becoming queen, oh, dear. A royal banquet of gigantic proportions, setting of luxury and splendor, utter prodigality. This is that 150 days of unbridled feasting. Then the huge storm with Vashti thwarting the king's wishes. Then the most beautiful girl in the empire turns out to be Esther. And Esther had been told by her uncle of a plot against the life of the king. And that, of course, she reports to her husband, and at some time, he's going to get his reward. Well, Haman rises to be the most prominent official.
Haman was a Persian, right?
No. This is really interesting. Haman is called an Agagite. And back in 1 Samuel 15, the prophet Samuel sent Saul, King Saul, a Benjaminite, as is Mordecai, is out to kill the Amalekites and wipe out all of them, the Amalekite clan, sometimes called the Canaanite, the Amalekites though. And he doesn't kill them all. He brings back the king whose name is Agag. And that's Mordecai is an Agagite. There is mortal enmity between the tribe of Mordecai, who is a descendant of the tribe of Saul, and Agag, and the Agagite Mordecai. Now, it's very interesting that not only
Haman,
did...
Sorry, Agag. So you have Mordecai. Yeah.
Mordecai is, yes, Jewish. Mordecai is the of Benjamin. Haman is of Agag.
Yeah.
Of Agagite. Now, the interesting thing is that apart from the king, Agag, being brought back by Saul for sacrifice, perhaps, he brings back a whole lot of spoil. Now, that spoil of all those things, but that's going to be for sacrifice in the temple, he says to Samuel. Samuel doesn't buy it and kills Agag with the sword. Now, you will notice that in the last chapter, when the battle is going on between the Jews now, who are supported by the leaders, and they're fighting against their enemies, they kill enemies but take no spoil. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, but take no spoil, you suddenly realize that the ancestry in that story from 1 Samuel 15, spoil was taken, and it led to the death. It led to Saul being losing the kingship, being deposed from the kingship by Samuel. So take no spoil suddenly takes on a new echo. And the enmity between Mordecai, who will not bow to Haman, takes on a new link with 1 Samuel 15. So some of these contacts are fascinating when you go into them. So yes, Haman plots against the Jews because one man will not bow to him. He wants to kill the whole race. So that, see, there's that extravagance again.
You have the woman who doesn't want to do things, who doesn't want to bow, and she is chased away. You have the man who doesn't want to bow, and
oh dear. Well, what happens then is a message is sent to Esther by Mordecai that this destruction of all the people, the Jewish people, is to take place. And Esther said, look, I can't go to the king. With Vashti, the sentence was that nobody was to go to the king unsummoned. And the only thing was he could pardon them if he holds out the golden scepter. Now, that's an excuse. I can't do it. And back comes the message from Mordecai. If you keep silence at such time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from some other quarter. Maybe that's an oblique reference to God. Who knows? That would be the only religious element in the book, in the Hebrew translation. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Is this the one significant moment that Esther has to carry out? I mean, this applies to everybody. Everybody, this is the point, that we all have some task to do in life. We don't know what it is at times. We don't even know the significance. And I think this is one of the most important features of the wisdom element of this book. So, what does Esther do? Well, they go and do a good Jewish thing. They fast, and all the people are to fast. And then she courageously goes in to confront the king. Now, in the Hebrew edition, the king sees her, all her finery, and calmly holds out the golden scepter to her. But in the addition course, his face is furious, enraged, and Esther faints with fear. And all of a sudden, God has to step in and change the heart of the king to become one of concern. You see why it is so important to read the book in two ways. Right.
I know that a lot of paintings from the Renaissance, I think, and from before, from Baroque paintings. There are a lot of paintings about Esther fainting.
Yes, yes. Well, that's why. And that's taken from the edition, right?
Yes.
But I mean, Esther has prepared for all of this with prayer, and so has Mordecai. So the prayers are recorded in the editions, right? So now, okay, what's Esther? Oh, the king is so moved. I will give you anything, even half my kingdom. Well, yes, but half the kingdom wouldn't solve the problem of the slaughter of the Jews.
Correct.
So therefore, she just comes up with the stratagem of, oh, we'll have a party. I want you and Haman to come to the party. And that night, we have the king sleepless in Susa. So he calls for the reading of the royal annals, and then he comes across this part about Mordecai reporting an assassination attempt on his life. Oh, what's been done for him? Oh, he must do something. And it just so happens that Haman has come back really upset because Mordecai had bowed to him again. And he's going to ask the king for the death of Mordecai. But the king said, oh, Mordecai, Haman, good. Send Haman. Say, Haman, listen, what would happen? What should the king do to someone he wants to honor? And, of course, what does Haman think? Me. So he comes up with this great elaborate plan of the horse of the king, the dressed finery, going in front saying, this is the way the king honors someone that he wishes to honor. And Haman finds to his horror he's got to do it for Mordecai the Jew. So that's the beginning of the great reversal. That's the key middle bit of the book.
Brother Kieran, I think that we don't have the time to tell the whole book.
Good.
So we'll have only 1 minute left. So
all will be well. Okay. But the reversal of it is so, it's beautifully told with the chiastic pattern of things matching, going up, all things across. It's a brilliantly structured book, an artistic triumph.
And there are some paintings of the death of Haman and of Esther in the Sistine Chapel. And we talked about
that
months ago. And we also have some pictures on the website of how Michelangelo saw it. And so that's just one sentence about its theology, Brother Kieran.
The theology is God works through people and can solve through us even the greatest mess that exists. The book ultimately is hopeful.
Thank you so much, Brother Kieran. That's a wonderful ending of the interview. And for people who want to know more, first of all, of course, you can read both versions, the Hebrew and the Greek version of the Book of Esther. But also join us on the 11th of September, so that's next Monday, 7 to 8:30 p.m. on Zoom. And we'll hear more about Esther. And so we have 11th and the 18th of September, our last two sessions of the series, The Women in the Bible. And for more information, for registration, to receive the Zoom link, etc., and information on current and past programs, please check out www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha, keep safe, and thank you, Brother Kieran.
Thank you.